C7. Number 23A.
And the very first sentence reads, Divine love is my shepherd. I shall not want. I, who is the I? Divine love is the I. I shall not want. I have no more any desires. I don't want any more anything. The I does no more want anything. And can you see how the textbook began? Textbook began with the desire, that desire first must be molded and exalted. And that desire was then somehow led on, and the desire was rising and rising and purified. And the whole chapter ends, I, love, shall not want. There is no more any I want. I wish. It's only the I, the great I am, in operation. And that operation, that calculus never wants anything. It just operates because it is a calculus. And you lose all that sense, I want this and I want that and I want the other thing. Golly, what a freedom. Can you see how it takes us right out of that human sense of existence and says, that's not it, that's the old earth and the old heaven. I have seen a new heaven and a new earth. So, I have given you a survey of what Mrs. Eddy tries to show in this chapter, and from the point of view of oneness, one always began to feel that actually nothing is ever going on but that divine principle operating as a calculus of idea, so that each idea is a calculus in its principle and operates in that principle. There is one calculus, she would indicate. There is not the material calculus that is adapted to a material world, to the old heaven and the old earth, and another calculus adapted to the new heaven and to the new earth, but that there is just one calculus, the calculus of spirit. This calculus, symbolized as the city foursquare, being also the city of our God, therefore being that we see that we are nothing else but the infinite calculation of the divine principle, that whatever principle calculates is his expression, no matter if we give to that expression the old term of universe or the old term of man or whatever it is. There is an old manuscript in the British Museum. It seems that it is one of the oldest manuscripts that gives record of Jesus' teaching. It has somewhere been found on a heap of, what you throw away? Trash, near Cairo. And it's one of the oldest. It's locked up in the British Museum. And one of the verses that has been saved there reads like this, and the kingdom of heaven is within you. That's what we have in the gospel too. And whosoever shall know himself shall find it. See, whosoever shall know himself shall find it. You remember how we started out really with the 13th chapter, know yourself, only those who are wise can increase in knowledge. So he doesn't say, whosoever does not know it shall at one time know it, but whosoever shall know himself, when we know ourselves as the operation of the idea, shall find the calculus, shall find it. And when ye have found it, ye shall know that ye are the sons and heirs of the Almighty Father. Well, that again sounds very much like the Gospels. And ye shall know that ye are in God, and God in you. That we have seen also in Genesis. And then is added a small sentence, and ye are the city of God. For the first time we hear now, and ye are the city of God. So that vision that Jesus showed to John the Revelator on the Isle of Patmos, he showed the city, that new Jerusalem, coming out from heaven, down from heaven. But Mrs. Eddy explains it the way, really, here, this saying goes. She explains it is the city of our God. It's us, the calculus, is not somewhere up in a principle, but the idea is a calculus. And so we can see we are the city of God. Nothing is ever going on than the infinite operation of that one principle as idea. So we have here that one calculus. In the chapter on Apocalypse, she shows that there is one book, and that book we have to read from the beginning to the end. It's one book open. And reading that one book, we have one coherent story. Now, when we see the whole interrelationship of all the ideas, of all the chapters within the book, we can see that the textbook is one consistent whole story and not a omnium gatherum of aphorisms and things like that. You call it omni gatherum of aphorisms, but that it is one consistent story, one web of consistency going through that whole textbook. It's one book, one story. One consistent story. For the first time in the book, and the only time in the textbook, she uses body in a positive sense. Nowhere else, but here she speaks about the body, eat the divine body of this principle. Body as a symbol for the consistency of the whole system, of the whole gestalt of that calculus of ideas. Eat the body of this principle, thus partaking of the nature or primal elements of truth and love. It is always one man that she is showing, woman clothed with the sun, man clothed with its principle. The spiritual idea is crowned with 12 stars. That idea has the power of demonstration. Men, really, as the great idea that is being born, a calculus of ideas. That's the sense of oneness I think we get here. Actually, what do we want to put into our 16th box as oneness? It's very difficult to point it out. We could say principle and idea operate as one. We could say principle and idea operate as one. Actually, I wonder if what he wants to bring out is just something even more simple, just oneness as such. Just oneness as such. Whatever is a sense of oneness. Oneness as such. Therefore, as duality that she presents here, duality as such. The belief of duality as such. Because when we consider the claim of duality that she brings up in this chapter and reads right through all the pages and just listens to the sense of duality, one doesn't really get some kind of a specified sense of duality as we had it in the other chapters. One feels everything is in it. Every kind of duality is brought up and resolved. That's why I felt perhaps the best thing is to just state oneness as such and duality as such, which actually would naturally be a climax for the whole textbook. She dissolves here practically every kind of duality. She brings up in those few pages, she brings up really that the duality of human and the divine is solved, that the duality of the relative and the absolute is solved. She brings in that the objective and the subjective attitude is solved, that understanding and demonstration as being one is, as being two is solved. The ascending and descending way is one way and not two ways. That spirit and matter is no more opposite. They are now stages and states of consciousness. That duality is also solved. The duality of God and man is solved, showing that God is the city of God and man is the city of God. Ye are the city of God. There is no more duality of God and man. The whole claim of human misery is solved just in one thing. It is, has its full compensation in the idea of love. It just seems that any aspect of duality that one can think of is brought up again in that last chapter. It is as if everything is brought up, as if all the 15 chapters somehow would be gathered together again, and one would ask now, what is it all about? Just saying, well, there is fundamentally just oneness, and there is fundamentally just one belief, and that's the belief in dualism, whatever the belief is. The whole problem of evil here is solved. It is full, the text is just full of that, how the problem of evil is solved. You have the symbol of the dragon as the sum total of human error. And of that dragon, she says, it's nothingness. It's dust to dust. It's a lie from the beginning. No accuser is anymore there. Why should we stand aghast at nothingness? Then, next to the dragon, we have the sea. There was no more sea, no more air. Then night. There is no more night, she says here. Then there are the seven vials, the seven thunders of evil. There are the seven last plagues. They all are fully compensated. They are an angel entertained unawares. There are no more seven thunders of evil. There are now an angel entertained unawares. So that what she wants to show, that evil, rightly viewed, is really the operation of the divine idea. That's what she finally, we could see here. That what we call the sum total of human misery is actually the divine infinite calculus in operation. Because it's only the divine infinite calculus that precipitates itself on the human calculus and says, I want to transform that human calculus, I want to overturn it, and I want to retranslate it back into a divine calculus. So, finally one gets a sense of a complete transparency of the universe. The night of materialism wanes. Sin is scientifically reduced to its native nothingness. This will destroy forever the physical plagues imposed by material sense. Into that city nothing can enter anymore which defileth and maketh a lie. There is no accuser there. And in this way, can you feel through that whole story of going up and down the dimensional sense, He just wants to take in and say that rightly governed from the point of view of science itself as the infinite principle, that infinite principle is an infinite calculus of idea, therefore comes to us in divine science as the foresight of the holy city, translates itself to absolute Christian science as the calculus of idea, man as a calculus of idea, and on the level of Christian science just makes nothing of anything. No more sea, no more night, all has disappeared, everything is resolved. There is only something going on, principle, idea is going on. And I think this may be perhaps in short terms, the law that is reigning here, that we can see what is being brought out, is that actually God operates as God idea. God operates as God idea. Then we have the correlation, God idea, and then we have the calculus operation, and that seems to be the pinnacle of this chapter, so that we can actually say, whatever happens, that we can say there is never anything going on than principle and its idea, or principle idea. So that whatever comes up in our human life, that the first reaction actually could be, there is never anything going on but principle idea. If we would go out from that standpoint, I think we would already gain our safety, our peace, our rest, our strength and power. There would be no fear, no doubt, no hesitation. We just would feel, the only thing I have to see, how this principle idea interprets itself to the various levels of consciousness. But it's always the operation of idea. In this way, we really would have solved the great question from where we started out, right at the beginning, namely that sense which the mystics rightly have, that there is nothing going on but the infinite. That whatever goes on is the infinite. They cannot explain it, and the 16th chapter explains it. But they arrive finally at the same statement that nothing is ever going on but the infinite one. Yes, so in this way we have considered the 16th chapter. What we have still to do is to see now what is the common denominator that runs through the last vertical, through the last four chapters. Well, let's see if we somehow spiritually can catch the tone. We recapitulate perhaps for ourselves quickly chapter 13 to 16 and see what was now really the purpose of the 13th chapter. It was that ethics of Christian Science which said it consists of what? Of adhering to the principle of Christian Science, and that our standpoint of how to adhere to the principle of Christian Science determines how much of a Christian scientist we are, just like in another science too. So we can see here we have a sense of being integrated into the one principle, and being integrated into the one principle, we are a Christian scientist. But then, and that naturally is a sense of oneness, to be integrated into the one being, and shows how the rule of adhering, sticking to the principle and rule. But then, when we adhere to the divine principle, we ask ourselves, well, what is that divine principle? What is the inner content of that principle. That principle constitutes itself of what? And so it shows, oh, a principle is always one with its system. A principle always includes within itself a scientific system of metaphysics, a scientific system of ideas. And so the Christ of that one science is its system. Then when we went further to Genesis, we began to see that actually this system is working within the divine principle. That it isn't something outside the divine principle. That if principle interprets itself through its system, that system is within the infinite one. So that we began to see that the integral being, the integral principle, is restructuring itself continually, and this appears to be a creation or a revelation. But actually it's a God Genesis, it's a principle Genesis, principle, not being static, not being just something, but always something else through its restructuring. And therefore we have an infinite God. And by an infinite God, we do not mean a God that is infinite in space and time, but infinite in its restructuring, infinite in showing itself forth always in a different way, and yet still remaining the same one principle. A solution to that whole question of one and the many. So that we can see that system of restructuring being is within being. So that finally in the 16th chapter we can see, well, then everything that goes on within that one being is always the whole calculus of that being, the whole principle of that being. It's never something outside of it, it's always reflecting the whole of that being, so that every idea is there always principle idea. Therefore, what may be the common denominator? Perhaps we may call it integrated being or integral being. Being that is an integral being where everything is integrated into the one. Integral being. Yes. Now, we can ask ourselves now, what are now the great big lines and categories of oneness? Through induction from the text, we have now find those four captions that we have on the top of each column. Of Word, Christ, Christianity, and Science. Now, let's look at those four epitomes. And what do we see? We see that we can fundamentally look at the oneness of being from the point of view of the Word, where we see that man is always one with God. But also to see from the point of view of the Christ. The Christ is always the relationship of God to man. We can see there is also a oneness of God and man, bringing out God's whole nature as man, at the point of idea. If it's as a point of idea, we begin to see then there must be a realm of idea. And so we come to Christianity and see the oneness at the point of idea is a universe, one universe. So you get one universe. And as we go on to science, we can see it. But that one universe, we must remember, is not outside of that oneness of God and man, but is integrated into that oneness of God and man. So that we see it is all one, integrated whole. an integral being. And in this way, we have four great aspects of oneness. In order to see if this is a correct index for a matrix, we don't yet have a matrix because we are building it up. Only when we have both indices stated rightly, we can say it is a matrix. But in the inductive way, we go just one step to the next. The next step is always to ask oneself, now, have these four captions, have they one common tone? Are they of one level or not? And we can see they are of one level, namely on the level of divine science. If we know the tonality of divine science, naturally we can see in the world that whenever we have unity or oneness, that's the tonality of divine science, in the world the oneness of man to God, God's oneness with man, oneness of universe, one integrated being. So in a way we can see we have found a rather reliable interpretation up to now, where we could see that actually that science of oneness has four different aspects of divine science on that index I. What is still missing would be the index J. And that is more difficult. And I think this is always perhaps that which is more questionable or more difficult to sense out spiritually and scientifically. And therefore, just make a mental note or a written note that it is an attempt to find the right answer, and that perhaps that is something which we may change as we go on.